Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me okay, or we got volume issues? Okay, well, if Steve can hear me, that's it. That's all I need to know. Okay, we've been talking about miracles, and this is going to be week three on miracles, and it'll be a miracle if I ever finish this. So we're going to have some more fun. I want to say a couple of things. First of all, I want to encourage people who don't usually say anything. If you're like right on the edge of saying something, and then somebody who usually says a lot, like John, jumps right in. If you're one of those people, you're the one I want to hear from this morning. So I'm going to open with something that Gordon told me, because he doesn't ask a lot of questions, and it was really good, and I'm going to let Gordon speak for himself. So Gordon, you're on. So that series of miracles, part of the reason for it was God bringing faith in Moses.
Moses developing faith through the process of his interaction with God, and with God's prompting and demonstrating these miracles. And that's why he went, and he had a very, very difficult time.
So you don't necessarily have to have faith to be witness of a miracle. Sometimes you're witness of a miracle, and then you have faith. What other thoughts have you guys had thinking about this during the week? Or raise your hand if you didn't think about it at all. That's okay, too. Steve, yes?
Yeah, I've heard a long time ago on radio and TV of the so-called faith healers who supposedly perform miracles like raising the dead. And how many of you have heard of Reverend A.A. Allen? Anybody remember him?
Some of those guys, Steve, are, I would say probably most of them are frauds.
Yes.
Yeah, I believe. And I think that one of the things we have to do in dealing with miracles is bring our own discernment into it, our own prayer about it, what does the Bible say about it, and analyze it and don't just accept it. Yes, sir. That's why I said most.
Most of them are frauds.
Yeah, most of them are frauds. I'm not going to point fingers at anybody specific because I believe God can do those things. I shared with you all the miracle, the physical miracle that happened to me when I was young. You know, that actually happened. It's in.
That was a genuine one.
It was. It's in my mind. It's in my consciousness. It's part of the reason I believe in them is because it actually happened to me. So I'm not going to point fingers. You're right. God can do everything, anything, but we just have to be aware that there are people out there who take advantage of the name of God and make a name for themselves rather than for God by doing this stuff. Warren?
What?
One of the things that becomes more pronounced in my mind is we hear from naturalists or materialists, which means atheists in sheep's clothing, that, well, there's a natural explanation for it. Therefore, there is no creator. How do you get from natural processes to the conclusion that there is no creator? That, there's no logical connection between those two statements.
No, there's not. And like you always do, Warren, you're like two steps ahead of me, and we're going to get there. You're really good at that. Yeah. All right, let's go through some of these we worked on last week, and what I want to do is give you some ideas and let you guys figure out what you think of these ideas. Are they bogus? How do we answer them? We talked about we no longer need miracles as an explanation for anything. Science can explain everything. We talked about science can only study events and entities that have a natural explanation. And I think we left off at this one. Did we do this one? Okay. Science and the miraculous are incompatible. That's another objection that you hear. How should we answer that, Warren?
Well, it depends on your definition of science. If science is restricted to materialism, which is the popular definition, then that's probably true. If science is a search for truth, if science means inquiry, then they're not incompatible.
So how, somebody in the class, give me a definition of science. How would you define science?
That which obeys the laws of physics.
Say it again.
That which obeys the natural laws of physics.
That which obeys the natural laws of physics. Okay. Ted?
Well, you'd have to look and consider that there are historical sciences such as geology, forensic science, to try to explain things that have occurred in the past that are not repeatable in the lab and that cannot be duplicated today. The origin of the universe, for instance. The birth of a star. There are things that we observe, yet we can't
duplicate them.
Right, we can't duplicate them or do experiments that confirm them or deny them. Then there are hard, duplicatable sciences to where you can perform an experiment or observe information and duplicate it, come up with a theory and test your theories.
Okay.
So there's several categories of historical and empirical.
I want to ask Rich, because Rich is a scientist. How do you define science? I'll put you on the spot.
Science is the study of the creation.
That's probably the best definition. John. Okay. Al, how would you explain it? Define it.
I would say it's kind of like Warren said. It's kind of incompatible in that science deals with material things that are provable, how the world is, what everything's made of, and stuff like that. Where you go into the miraculous, you're into the...
Well, let me ask you this, Al, and I'll ask the class, too. Is science about the process of discovery, or is it about the discovery itself?
The process.
Okay. What if you take a scientific approach to studying a particular phenomenon, and that phenomenon winds up not having a naturalistic basis? Are you still doing science?
No.
Why?
Because if it can't be explained, it's in another realm. Science deals with reality.
But you said science was about the process.
But science has tried to look into, say, prayer. Somebody mentioned they ran their
So the process of looking at prayer is not a scientific process?
They did it scientifically.
Okay.
You know, several.
So it was science.
Yeah, it was science. Several religious Harvard.
So if they came up with a non-naturalistic explanation after a scientific process, are they still doing science?
Yeah.
Okay, that's right.
They came up with it. They found out that the prayer, intercessory prayer, is just like chance. You know,
okay, now, let's say they had found the opposite, which a lot of studies have. Let's say they found that intercessory prayer in a double-blind study process so that no one could know what was going on. Let's say it actually did yield positive results. Would you say that the study of it and the conclusion was scientific?
It's still
scientific. I agree with you. Okay, so science is about the process of inquiry, not necessarily about the finding. The finding could be, we could find some really weird thing that we can never, ever, ever explain. Okay. All right. Would you agree with that, Rich? Well, explain.
I think it's both. I wouldn't say it's just the process, because, you know, we do the process, but we're aiming at a goal.
And what is the goal?
The goal is to discover the truth.
And is the truth always explainable naturalistically?
No, sometimes it's not explainable. Anyway.
Okay. So, science and the miraculous are incompatible. That's what we're answering. We got off a little bit. But they are completely different things. Let's say, imagine before Einstein, when we had a Newtonian view of the mechanics of the universe. Newton thought he could explain everything by those views. Then we found this perturbation in the orbit of Mercury. It could not be explained by Newtonian mechanics. Nobody called it a miracle. They said, well, we have to modify our laws of mechanics, and Einstein eventually came up with the theory of relativity. But it could have been a miracle. The point is that whatever our theory is in science, there's always going to be something comes up that's outside of that theory that maybe we can explain it naturalistically later on, maybe we can't. So science and the miraculous are not incompatible. Science and scientific explanations are not incompatible. So whatever new comes up might be miraculous, might not. So, John, does that make sense?
Yeah, science is a methodology. The results are what they are, or conclusions are what they are.
So it's about, yeah.
It points toward the miraculous or the natural.
So it is about the process.
It's a process. And people have to define the difference between science and the scientific method. The scientific method is repeatable in the laboratory. Okay, so the fact that Reagan was president is not provable by the scientific method. And so there are, I guess you could say, scientific methods outside of the scientific method.
Right. Well, is the scientific method the only way to do science?
No.
Would you agree with that, Rich?
The scientific method has changed a lot lately because it's the way people look at data, you know, because it used to be that you would have this very narrow field, you would have a hypothesis, you would test it and everything, but, you know, like in certain realms like genetics, you don't do that anymore. You shotgun everything. So you take a process, you run it, you look at, you know, 24,000 genes, and you pull out the ones that are doing something, and then you can put them together into a pathway at some other point. But you don't start with a hypothesis. You start with data, then you go to hypothesis, then you test it further on.
That's a little like historical or forensic history.
Like paleontology is not repeatable.
Yeah. Like ethnology.
Mark, how would Kuhn have defined science?
He defined science as the enterprise, social enterprise,
that an enterprise never approaches truth, never finds truth in a capital T. As a matter of fact, we made a big deal out of that in the 1951 version of the Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And so when he defined science, he defined it sociologically as well as methodologically, where he said they're out trying to solve puzzles. Scientists solve puzzles. When you run into anomalies, they try and deal with those anomalies. When they become too numerous, it becomes a crisis. And when the crisis occurs and a competing paradigm arises, then some people will adopt a new paradigm. And if it sticks, then the old people and the old paradigm die off. The new paradigm takes over. And there's a period of tension between the earlier and the newer paradigm, which is called the crisis phase. And a lot of interesting things happen there, including what is, as Kuhn called it, a moving away from science as we know it and moving into philosophy. He said one of the ways you can even detect when a crisis occurs is when scientists start talking philosophically rather than scientifically. So Kuhn's definition would be very complex in that regard. And if you go into the philosophy of science more deeply, the question of the definition of science itself is problematic. As a matter of fact, it's called the demarcation problem. What is science and what isn't science? And if you go into, you know, a dozen philosophy of science books and ask them what's the definition of science, the first thing they'll say is, we don't really have a singular, perfect, idealized definition of science. And so you hear all these different versions of people talking about here. They're all right. They're all right. They're all correct. We're all trying to describe or predict something or create a fruitful program for investigation. But there isn't only one way, and there isn't only one so-called scientific method.
So Kuhn would not even agree with the idea that science is a search for the truth.
He would say it's a search for the truth, but you never achieve it. And then he explicitly says science will not find truth with a capital T.
It sounds like science is almost an art form rather than what we think of as hard, cold science.
Well, his answer was that the problem of induction, we cannot know the future, is always going to be settled.
Okay.
And because of that, there will always be something that we don't know. And no matter how much we research, there will always be something we don't know.
And that
reverse what we thought we knew.
And that thing that we don't know could potentially be miraculous. Or it could fit in with some new natural law that's as yet undiscovered.
Well, that was profound, and my comment is much less profound.
Well, to be quiet.
naturalistic science has produced marvelous results. There's no question about that. It's practiced by atheists. It's practiced by Christian science. But it describes natural effects. One thing it doesn't do is come up with hypotheses or theories about origins, about why is it that we have natural processes? How?
Or rationality in the first place.
What? Or why do we have rationality, intentionality, will? And why is the universe logical? And why is mathematics harmonious? Those kinds of things, and those are all beyond the boundary of naturalistic science. So it's not a criticism of that methodology, it's just to recognize where its boundary is.
Right. Okay, so one thing I wrote down here that I want to say that sort of sums this up. Science cannot rule out anything from happening. The miraculous, the non-miraculous, it can only try to explain what has already happened and been observed. Okay? So if somebody lays this on you, they are different things. Does that make sense? Is there somebody who doesn't usually raise their hand who has a question on the tip of their tongue? I can see it. I can sense it. Come on, somebody. Ted?
Well, you can look at science from another dichotomy. Is science descriptive? In other words, it describes what's happened in the past according to your theory, idea, hypothesis, and law. Or is it prescriptive? In other words, here's this law, and nature is forced to follow it.
In other words, Einstein's law of relativity, or whatever, or Newton's laws of gravitation, I expect to see the universe will respond the next time I do an experiment that way. Does it force nature to do that? No. Nature could do something totally different. I could, you know, drop this coffee cup and it could go up or just sit there in the middle of the air. Boy, that's weird.
So ultimately,
I expect it to do something, but it don't have to do it.
So ultimately, for us to say that because there are laws of science, if something we observe does not follow that law, something that doesn't follow the laws of science can't happen, that's kind of arrogant, isn't it? It's saying we completely understand how the universe works.
Right, it's descriptive, not prescriptive.
Al?
Yeah, I think you're looking at the wrong thing here. I think it's common knowledge that science is a search for knowledge. And what we ought to look at is what is a miracle? Now, in the time of Jesus and the Old Testament, you know, miracles were everywhere. Jesus made a bunch of them. But now that we know that science, we know, like I said, we don't believe doctor, what's that minister that healed everybody, Dr. Hinn or whatever it is.
Benny Hinn.
All we know, these guys are frauds. And
no, we don't know that, Al.
That.
No, we don't know that.
You don't follow these people and see what happens afterwards. In fact, this might happen.
So you're saying then, I mean, you've been here the last 3 weeks, right? Then you're saying that what I described that happened to me as a miracle was somehow a fraud.
You call it a miracle.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not science.
And so where does your confidence come from that it wasn't a miracle?
Well, you can call it anything you want. You can call it chance.
Where does your confidence come from that it wasn't a miracle?
I don't have confidence that it wasn't a miracle.
Then,
because you can call it anything you want.
No, I'm not talking about calling it what I want. I'm talking about miracle within the definition of what we've been talking about up here. I know that was miraculous. It had no scientific explanation. There's probably a dozen or two people in this room that have had similar experiences that aren't explainable. Your belief that ultimately it is explainable is a faith. And it's a faith that's not grounded in science. It's not grounded in philosophy. It's your faith. And that's okay.
And science cannot measure that, right? It can't measure it.
What do you mean it can't measure it?
No, you can't go in there and say, well, this is a miracle, and prove that it's a miracle scientifically. You can't do that.
Well, you can't prove that it's not a miracle.
No, exactly. So I'm saying that science cannot prove, doesn't get into this miraculous thing.
So the real issue then comes down to whether we believe in the miraculous at all. Well, no, you have faith too, Al. Your faith is as strong as mine. It's just in different direction. Okay. Okay, so don't try to talk about science versus faith. It's faith versus faith, just different directions.
I'm saying they're incompatible.
No, they're not incompatible.
That's philosophical.
Yeah.
That is a philosophical position, and as Mark pointed out, scientists trying to prove their point about origins, things like that, often migrate from methodological naturalism to philosophical naturalism, as we saw in Stephen Hawking's The Grand Design, and we see it in a lot of naturalistic, atheistic scientists who, when they try to reach outside the boundary of naturalistic science to explain the meaning of things, or where things came from, or why there are natural processes at all, they really get stuck.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So, is a worldview that includes miracles any less scientific than one that doesn't? So science, John? Exactly. So science cannot rule out the miraculous. Science only tries to describe what has happened. What has happened and is observable. And what has happened, we don't always know how it happened. Mr. Philosopher, yes, sir.
Where do you know? I think if you want to reach the same.
Anyways, I'm just. I think this has been said before. It's just, I mean, say 1,000 years ago, somebody was riding in a plane. Well, to the people, that would be a miracle. But if something happens, before we discuss the Bible, the parting of the Red Sea, some people say it was the wind or it was the Reed Sea, and nature was it was a natural phenomenon, but coincidentally, it happened just as the Jews were crossing. But could it? I mean, science. When you say science, it doesn't know everything all at once. So if something miraculous happens, like some scientists will say, well, wait, we'll find the scientific answer to this so-called miraculous thing. I mean,
Well, I think that personally, I think that looking at trying to find a naturalistic explanation for things is a very fruitful approach. It has been the basis for technology and science that we have now. A lot of times the church did ascribe the miraculous to something that later on we figured out there were natural causes for. So I think methodological naturalism is a very healthy, conservative approach. We should look for that naturalistic explanation always. I mean, I had a miracle happen to me. I've been very skeptical of it. I've analyzed it, thought about it, prayed about it, dismissed it. It wasn't just, oh, that happened. Gee, that was cool. That was part of it. But I really tried to take a dispassionate look at it. And I think that's a very healthy way to look at it. But to then say that if we rule out, you know, if we study something for years and years and decades and centuries and we can't come up with a naturalistic explanation, to stop there and say that the non-naturalistic, the miraculous, is impossible, is that's an act of faith. That's not a scientific... That's right. It's not a scientific conclusion. When all else fails, the miraculous is a reasonable explanation to at least pursue.
It's a saying that I had come up with a long time ago, or had heard a long time ago and kind of followed it for some time, but haven't thought about it recently, but have always believed that to be true, is that sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from a miracle. And so go far enough in advance of your own technology, you're not going to be able to tell whether it's a miracle or not.
Right. That's true, although, you know, I'm going to argue that there are some things that can happen. Some things that, if they happened, pretty much everybody would agree that they're miraculous. I think somebody who's dead 4 days and gets raised from the dead, I don't think we're ever going to have a naturalistic explanation for that. So I think there's some things that are like, I don't care where science goes, that's a miracle.
If you take an Apple computer and go back 3,000 years and show the pharaohs this Apple computer, there's no way they're going to be convinced it's not a miracle.
So you're saying that someday we could come up with an explanation for somebody 4 days dead that's great?
The point I was making with that statement is not that it's going to be come up with a natural explanation. It's just there's no way for us at this point in time to distinguish between the miraculous and something sufficiently high technology beyond our capability.
I think there are... Mark and I have this conversation a lot. This is something he and I have explored a lot. We talked about it last week. I think the idea of information is an exception to what you're saying. I think that when you have anything, this up here, this writing on here, you have information that is coherent, that conveys a message from one person to another, from one entity to another, even from one computer to another. Each one of those letters, each word, each space between the word, each sentence had to be constructed thoughtfully, carefully, with a conscious mind, putting the words together, just like your sentence that you just told me. I don't think we'll ever find a naturalistic explanation for information that is coherent, that is a reasonable explanation.
Okay,
so when you look at the cell, and the first life form that we think existed on Earth, and it has as much information in it as a 300-page novel, and somehow that came into existence all at once, or pretty close to all at once, and it's full of coherent information. I don't think you can ascribe that to any random process or any naturalistic process. That had to have been thought through by a conscious entity that had the power and the means to figure it out and build it. And so it's a philosophical question. Can information ever come from a random naturalistic process? But I think it's, in my mind, it's so completely unlikely and so different than in any other way that we see information coming together in our world, that, you know, I will say information cannot come into existence by itself, information that means anything. I mean, you could take a random collection of letters and throw them out like dice and have information, but it's not coherent. It doesn't perform, it doesn't communicate anything or do any function.
So there's a huge number of authors of philosophers of science who agree with you that information comes from an intelligent source.
Yes. John?
Well, and with regard to someone being dead, absolutely dead for 4 days, and then, you know, setting up and being alive again, that can be described as advanced technology by a hyperdimensional self-existent being that has the ability to transcend space-time.
It sounds like Santa Claus.
It can be described as advanced technology.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but all the words you used have no meaning in our understanding of science as we know it.
Well, they did have understanding for scientists in the 18th and 19th centuries. They incorporated a theistic view very strongly in their work, and they understood and believed that there was the operation of divine being in what they observed and the way things were.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with that. I think we should always, this may not make sense, but I'm very passionate about the things that I believe, and I try to hold many of them as light as a feather, because there's so many things that we don't know that God is going to share with us that, you know, if something new comes along, you have to be able to let go of it and come up with a new way of looking at it, and at the same time have a faith that transcends all the goofy stuff that goes on in your life. It's a difficult thing.
Whatever we talk about, the actions of God, they are miracles.
What if they completely follow natural law?
No, it's God actions.
God didn't.
Anything that comes from God is God.
But the Bible says He holds all things together by the power of His word. So everything that's happening, whether it fits into natural law or not, is miraculous. But then if you define that as miraculous, then there's no distinction between the miraculous and the non-miraculous. And that's why it's like trying to define science. It's like trying to define beauty. These are not things that have a tight, perfect explanation. We all know what we're talking about when we say it, but there's a lot of fuzzy ways to look at it. Warren?
If you can look at natural processes and not be amazed, that they themselves are miracles,
then you don't believe in God.
Then,
because that's really the.
I think you've got a blind spot.
Well, you and I would agree on that. Ted.
Richard Dawkins, a very notable atheist, comments himself: "We continuously have to remind ourselves that this does not display design, conscious." That's maybe 15% of what he says is that continual reminding of himself that design does not imply a designer.
Yeah, I've heard that.
That's a major part of his work.
Let's go on. Let's take a Okay, I'll make it quick.
I think we throw the word around, miracle around too loosely. 200 years ago, they would have said, if somebody said, we're going to go to the moon, somebody said, that would have to be a miracle, right? We're at the moon right now.
I think everybody understands that.
Yeah, I know.
I'm using the word miracle as something that can never be explained by natural law.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Yeah. That's true.
The whole technology argument is specious because it presumes that at the moment the event occurs, technology can solve that problem in exactly the same way. And the whole essence of a miracle is that technology at that moment could not.
Very good point. Gordon?
Yeah, I wanted to ask Al if there is controversy between what he believes and what many of us believe. Have you ever experienced anything in all of your years that was so extremely unusual that maybe we could perceive it and came to the goal? But how about you?
I was talking with Dan a little while ago. He was telling me about how he was a miracle. He thought it was a miracle, but he thought he was on the plane and had three times or so and the plane was out of control and he saw, a miracle. I said, get on the freeway. And the freeway is going at 60 miles an hour and you're that far away from one car and you're farther than the fact that you arrive home safely. You can say it's a miracle.
But
what
can you share with us personally, on a personal level, that is so what we would call miraculous or a life-changing experience that you have?
I can say, well, I was born normally, without any defects, without any serious malady or whatever. You can call it a miracle. For the fact that we're here.
But those aren't the kind of miracles we're talking about, Al. Yeah, I don't want to take too long with this because I don't think we're going to... All right, let's take apart. I want to start with taking apart some philosophers' statements here. This is Benedict Spinoza, lived in the 1600s. This is a summation of his points. Number one, miracles are violations of natural laws. Number two, natural laws are immutable. Number three, it is impossible for natural laws to be violated. Number four, therefore, miracles are impossible. How do we answer that? How do you mean circular?
Well, he defines miracles out of existence by saying there's nothing but natural law, and therefore there are no miracles. I mean, that's the summation of what he's doing, and you have to question his premise. How do you know that there's nothing but natural law? And so therefore, the circular reasoning is cut. A lot of materialists, atheists, do that. Science, only that which can study natural.
We did that last week,
yeah,
right.
And that defines things to your own convenience. It's not a scientific difference.
It's coming up with a definition that excludes what you're studying and saying it doesn't exist.
Yeah, you define your opponents out of existence.
Well, remember before I discussed the prescriptive versus descriptive nature of science and natural law? Supposing Richard or another scientist or Dr. Ross propounds a theory and he makes observations in nature and here's the theory about it. Is nature forced in the next occurrence of a natural phenomena to follow exactly what Dr. Ross has found? Does that law force nature to do anything? No. He's described what he's observed during his lifetime with his experiment.
That's right.
It's descriptive, not proscriptive. If he were God Almighty, then he could prescribe. That's going to happen. Poof, and then it happens.
Are
anything what Dr. Ross does, or Einstein, or Spinoza, or any of us in this room, that's God's prerogative to do those things.
Are any of these statements necessarily true?
No. Every one of them can be argued.
I think the first one.
Every one of them.
Every one of these seems to be have a violation within itself. Miracles are violations of natural law. Well, how do you, you got to prove that point? It's just provable because it's outside of its self-explanatory edict. I don't know what you define, first of all. Number two, natural laws are immutable. Well, how do you know they're immutable? What's the ideology of that?
So how much philosophy and ideology is behind this, Alan?
I mean, there is a definition of a miracle outside natural law, so isn't that kind of just common sense? No?
No.
What do you think?
A miracle, as we talked about, can violate natural law in the sense it could override it if God so wishes. But he has the ability to override his own laws if he so desires. But he usually doesn't do that. Sometimes miracles are the use of natural laws whose timing otherwise would not have occurred, such as the parting of the Red Sea with the strong wind that blew on it. There was material behind that. He was using some natural laws there of wind and what causes wind to accomplish a miraculous event in terms of timing. So it's not necessarily a violation of natural law.
Right. Yes, sir.
My question about that is, how can the theory about Joshua stopping the sun in the sky, which we know that did not, cannot happen if you collide into the sun, how can you turn around and say that's justifiable?
Well, if God could stop the sun, he could hold the earth in place. I mean,
well,
one foregoes.
There's one other way to look at that. Remember how there's only 3,000 words in biblical Hebrew other than names. Every word had different meanings. A lot of that stuff, when we try to translate it, it can be very vague in what it meant. It may have meant, and so much of what is described in the Old Testament is from the point of view of the observer. So when it says in the Bible that the sun comes up out of its chamber and goes down at night, that's from the point of view of the observer. It's not that the sun is actually moving across the sky. We know that it's the earth that's rotating that gives us that viewpoint. So it's possible that those passages are describing something that was happening to the viewer on the surface of the earth and not taking a scientific celestial view looking at the solar system dispassionately like we think of it. I don't have a specific answer. I'm just saying sometimes that the Hebrew words and the way they look at it, you have to take that into context.
A few months ago right here, Hugh offered an explanation for that specific phenomenon, the stopping of the sun, based on his going to the site where that happened, looking at the geography, looking at the weather patterns, that sort of thing, said that there was a naturalistic explanation for that. And we've seen to the people at that time the sun couldn't stop.
Right, so it was a viewpoint issue. Doesn't mean it wasn't miraculous, but it may not be the way that we are translating it.
Together to make that
right.
Look like it happened was miraculous.
Okay, let's go. I'm going to skip a couple of these. This one is interesting. Anthony Flew is notable because he's the philosopher that at the end of his life became a theist. He became a believer in God from what he said was the scientific evidence. But this was his line of reasoning against the miraculous. Miracles are by nature particular and unrepeatable. Natural events are by nature general and repeatable. In practice, the evidence for the general and repeatable is always greater than that for the particular and the unrepeatable. Therefore, the evidence will always be greater against miracles than for them. It's a little bit different line of reasoning. How do you answer this? How would you answer this? First of all, are there any of the statements that can be taken as true all the time?
I think number four.
Well, that's a conclusion, Al. Okay. Is the first statement always true?
No.
Not necessarily, but I think for the purposes of the argument, we could say generally I think it's true. Natural events are by nature general and repeatable. Is that true?
No.
Give us an example of something that's not.
An explosion or creation of the moon.
Anything that's only happened once doesn't fit this. Right? So you're saying that all the historical sciences aren't really science, if you agree with statement number two. All the things that Ted was talking about.
All paleontology is dead.
That's right. How do you know that Lincoln was the 16th president? Can you test that scientifically? Yeah, I saw it last night. It's amazing. We can't prove it. So number two sort of proves too much. It reaches a lot further than I think he would have wanted it to. In practice, the evidence for the general and repeatable is always greater than that for the particular and unrepeatable. How many people in this room have ever won the California lottery?
Not even
a dollar. No, the big one. How many people know somebody who won the California lottery?
Nobody.
Mark?
Yeah, he's a neighbor.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know him personally, but he won $22 million.
Wow. Wow. Well, I was gonna assume that, but nobody in class has ever won it. So if one of you comes to me next week and says, "I won the California lottery," I'm either gonna say, "Give me some," or I'm gonna say. You know what? In practice, the evidence for the general and repeatable is always greater than that for the particular and unrepeatable. I don't believe you.
Bring in the check.
Right.
Well,
right.
Greater than, you know, see, it's an obvious statement. So what?
Yeah, anything that happens that's uncommon, you know, you roll a dice and you get a number 6 10 times in a row, is a violation of statement number 3. This doesn't work. Okay.
Maybe generally true.
But uncommon things happen within the laws of nature. John, were you going to say something?
I'm interested in the slide to skip over.
Yes.
Well, Hume was, I think, widely taken to have disproved miracles. But I think if you read Hume, and I'm guilty if I haven't, but what he tried to demonstrate, and I think did, not that miracles are impossible, but that it was impossible to prove that a particular event was or was not a miracle. And he did it by attacking, basically by accepting the idea that a miracle is a violation of natural law. Then examining how we know about natural laws and the process of putting those together by induction and all these strange phenomena. At the time something new comes up, and we use, for example, the centricity of the orbit of Mercury, we add that new phenomenon to our mass of inductive knowledge and ability. And so he comes out with the idea that anything that appears to be a miracle should properly be added to our set of empirical observations by which we make these laws. And what I think he's really done is disprove the possibility of natural law.
Interesting. I've got two more I want to do, and if we have time, I'll go back to Hume. This guy says basically the same thing you're talking about. Try this one. This one's very interesting. Alistair MacKinnon. Number one, a scientific law is a generalization based on observation. Number two, any exception to a scientific law invalidates that law and calls for a revision to it. Number three, a miracle is an exception to a scientific law. Number four, therefore, a miracle would call for a revision of a law and the recognition of a broader law. This would explain the miracle as a natural event. Okay. So can any of these statements be taken as true all the time? Oh, I think one is. One's pretty decent. Now, is two a always true statement?
I would have to take an exception to your number one is true, because a law is well beyond a generalization. It is something that has been proven each and every time you have observed it, no exceptions.
Well, then,
that's stronger than a generalization.
But then you're excluding the miraculous by your definition. Mark?
It's not about science here.
Okay.
It's observation of natural phenomena.
Okay.
Scientific law is specifically intended to generalize.
in a generalizing sense that it applies generally all over the universe, not just in one particular case. So the term generalization there doesn't mean vagueness, it means application universal. So when we say, you know, Einstein's theory applies above the quantum level, we mean that it applies the same way in one end of the universe as the other, and that we generalize it that way. That's what the generalization, that's what McKinnon is.
So you would agree that number one is true all the time?
Yes.
Okay. Warren?
Well, I think 1, 2, and 3 are definitional by in their nature.
Mm-hmm.
And you can argue about the definition.
Okay, so number 2, any exception to a scientific law invalidates that law and calls for a revision to it. What's wrong with that idea? Does... Val.
Okay. They make it sound like scientific law rules everything, governs everything, but I think God's law transcends scientific law. So if God overreaches, goes beyond just what we know as the usual, you can't compare that. It's not apples to apples. And I think every one of these people do that. They limit God to just the natural law.
Doesn't
an exception does not necessarily invalidate law.
Very good. Can if a miracle occurs, can the scientific law still be a scientific law?
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
By definition of a scientific law, other than what it's saying here, is being a description of natural phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
That does not make an exception to it because God did something.
Yeah.
I couldn't prove it, though.
Well, no, you can't prove it.
I can't prove it. Like on number 3, if you were to take that like 3,000 years ago, let's just say a miracle, how many grounds, and you give them mouth to mouth to divide them.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, it would be considered a miracle, but yet if you go behind that, scientifically of how it's done, then it's not really a miracle. It's scientifically, it can be done.
But let's say something happens that we study it for an infinite amount of time. We have that much time. 10,000 years we study it scientifically, and we never come up with a natural explanation for it. What I'm trying to say is that it's reasonable at some point to say, possibly this is miraculous. Yeah. Remember that as people of faith, as believers in God, we believe that God has the means and the power to interrupt the natural processes. Okay, so I'm going to use that example that I used with a tennis ball last time, only I'll do it with money because it's the only thing I have in my pocket. If I take this dollar bill and I throw it over here, it rolls, it bounces, it stops. Everything that happened with that dollar bill, from the time it left my hand to the time it hit the ground and stopped, if we could look close enough at the movement of every molecule of air, we could explain that completely with natural causes, how it did everything it did. Okay? But if I wad up another dollar bill and I throw it at Al, and Al catches it. Now, let's say you couldn't see Al. Let's say Al was invisible. Some of us wish he was. Let's say Al was invisible, and you saw the dollar bill go towards that seat, and it stopped in midair in his hand. You couldn't see Al. All you could see is the dollar bill. That would look miraculous, right? But it was Al's free will to put his hand out and catch the dollar bill. And what we're trying to do as people who believe in God is say that that's the same thing God does. He has the power and the means to interrupt the natural process. He does it in a way that we can't observe the method, and it looks miraculous. And it is miraculous because it's not explainable by natural law. You catching that dollar bill isn't explainable by natural law because your free will told you to put the hand out and see if you could get it in your pocket before I noticed it. Okay? Yeah. That's exactly right. You could have dodged it. You could have swatted it back. So by looking at miracles as something that God does that interrupts the natural process, doesn't invalidate the law. Any more than you catching the dollar bill invalidated the law of inertia and gravity and motion.
I think this goes back to what we're talking about the analogy thing again. What one analogy would be to make another one true? Because you're saying he, with his free will, grabbed that. So God, with his free will, can sort of, in being invisible, do something like that that would make it miraculous.
Yeah.
But again, that analogy, to me, doesn't seem that one makes the other one.
It doesn't, but it is the analogy that I'm using, so people at least have an image in their mind and they can think it through and they can ultimately say, yes, Ross, you're right, or you're completely nuts. Okay.
You're right, you are nuts.
Thank you. I want to do one more because I've got all these philosopher guys who do this professionally, and I think there's an argument that I found on the internet that is actually a stronger argument than any of the rest of them, and it's going to take us a little more time to work on it. So I want to do this one because I think it's cool.
Email.
If God, listen to this very carefully because this is a very powerful argument. If God will cheat or boast that he can or does intervene in our lives in the natural order, or for any purpose not even disclosed to us, it makes observation of the world and the affairs of the tiniest microbes to galactic catastrophe all futile, for they are then placed at the whim of a fickle God who will deceive us when it suits him. Therefore, to test that God exists by appeal to observations of this world and its affairs is quite futile. If God has intervened in the world even once, then no observation or consequent observation we can make is reliable. Do you understand what he's saying? He's saying that if God's going to cheat even once and interfere in the natural process, then maybe everything we're seeing or that we're observing to try to make sense of the universe, maybe that's a cheat too. How do we answer this?
Not quite answering your question, but because of the fact that he used the improper form of "it's there," nothing what he says there could be the one.
Well, again, this was not a professional philosopher. Warren.
Science doesn't claim to arrive at truth. They claim to arrive at reasonably reliable conclusions.
Do you think that most scientists don't have in their mind at least a general understanding that they're driving towards the truth?
And that
what we have now is more truthful than we had 10 years ago or 100 years ago?
Absolutely, and 10,000 years from now. And
right.
So on. But I think they would readily acknowledge that it's an imperfect process. It's a great process, but it's imperfect.
Okay, so how is that an answer to this? What he's saying is if God performed one miracle, then everything is untrustworthy.
No, you have 999 observations where it happens, the result is A. You've got one miraculous where it's B. It doesn't invalidate the 999.
But you're making the assumption that it's of that ratio. Maybe if what he's saying is that if we grant the idea that there is a God who exists who can interrupt the natural order, maybe he's doing it so often that we can't even trust our own rationality and our ability to analyze things.
What happens if that one, this person is making a lot of superlative philosophical conjectures in their notice, cheat, boast, deceived.
Mm-hmm.
He's already proceeding from a very biased perspective. Number two, your statement that you just ended with, that would be true of an evolutionary perspective. An evolutionary perspective, everything is random. And if everything is random, how can you trust your own thinking?
So most scientists are going to come at this from an evolutionary viewpoint.
Yeah, now they don't think it out, because if everything is purely a random tinker toy set, again, you have no free will, and you can't even trust your own conclusions because it may be just a random event.
That's right.
Only be a random event.
And if there's a God who exists who can poke in at any time that he wants, we can't trust anything. Now, I agree his language is very biased, but his argument is a very interesting argument.
Jeremiah says that the physics of the universe are fixed. They're doesn't say that God can't override them from time to time, but as a general rule, they are fixed and immutable.
Okay, you're getting close to where I want to go. Susan.
I'm probably not, but I also have just the language he uses, but God had a purpose for interruption. His purpose was to let us know that he exists.
Okay, the two statements that you both have made, what does it say about God?
He's not fickle.
He's what?
He's already given whatever
he wants. Okay.
He's a loving and orderly God, not a super being who's fickle, powerful.
Okay, so can you say it louder?
He's a loving and orderly God.
Hang on, Steve, not you. Hang on.
He's a loving and orderly God, not a God of chaos and whimsy and fickleness.
Okay. That's right. Hang on, Al. Hang on. So, we as Christians don't believe in any capricious God. So, this argument really is where you can answer and say, as a Christian, we don't believe in any God. We believe in a God that is described in the pages of the Bible. This could apply to other religions. This could apply to some Eastern religions. There's some Eastern religions that believe in a God that looks like this. But what is... Hang on, Al.
Concerning Job, God didn't do nothing. God allowed the devil to do so he could prove a point.
Oh, yeah, God up there
allowed it, okay? And at the end of, if you read the book, at the end of the book with Job, God blessed him above everything he had and then some. And even with Elijah and Elisha, when Elisha was afraid when all of the army was against him, Elijah said, open his eyes so he can see that there's more of us than there is of him, because the angel of God was all around protecting them. So whatever God does, he allows, whatever takes place in this world, God allows to take place. Even when you go through the Red Sea, they didn't just run through the Red Sea on wet ground. It was dry. Can you explain that miracle? No one can explain that miracle. They can say, well, the wind this and the wind that, but the wind doesn't dry the ground supernaturally within a millisecond of the time it takes place. So almost everything that's going on, you know, people have a lot of non-belief, of negativity, but negativity is not the devil. You know what I mean?
Okay, so thank you. What I'm trying to say here is we don't believe in any possible described God. We believe in a God that is described in the pages of the Bible. What does the Bible say about the nature of God? 2 Corinthians 13:11. And the God of love and... Ow! Knock it off. Don't smirk. It's not becoming. And the God of love and peace will be with you. Okay, first of all, this defines God in a particular sense. This is very powerful. Peace or order in the universe, a general order which is almost always followed, is a description of God's peace. It is a way that makes things somewhat predictable. Yet he also is described as a God of love. So he's not going to do things that are outside of that. The miracles that he performs are not going to be capricious or like doing card tricks or showing off. They're going to be for a loving purpose. Alan?
Well, it also says in the Old Testament, correct me if I'm wrong, that God is vengeful and ruthless and not willed.
It doesn't describe him that way.
No.
It says he is. There are places where it says he is angry. He is jealous, but he's. If you look at the acts that he performed in the Old Testament, where he just wiped out people and children and cattle and everything, that was after a very long process of giving them a really long chain, and finally they got to the point where they completely and utterly and irreversibly rejected him. Always. Okay, what else does the Bible say about God? Here's the Old Testament. Yes, but it's always within the context of love. And justice.
It never says vengeful.
It says vengeance is mine,
vengeance.
It saith the Lord. But if you look at everything else the Bible says about God, you have to assume that vengeance is within the context of love and patience and kindness. When people are done, when they finally reach the end. Jeremiah 33:20. This is really powerful. My covenant with the day and my covenant with the night, so that day and night come at their appointed time. This is a verse where he shows that he has appointed a general order to the universe. Psalm 111:7-8. The works of his hands are faithful and just. It's not just his precepts. It's not just his laws and his ideas. The works of his hands, the things he's made, are faithful and just. All his precepts are trustworthy. They are steadfast forever and ever, done in faithfulness and uprightness. So anything that's legitimately done by God, anything done miraculously or non-miraculously, as Christians we believe is in this context. 1 Corinthians 14:33, for God is not a God of disorder, but of peace. So he's not a capricious God. He's not going to do little random things here and there to keep himself entertained. John 17:17, sanctify them by the truth. Your word is truth. So the natural order is a statement by God towards us. He can interrupt it as he wants to, but it's always within the context, we believe as Christians, of how God is described in the Bible. And I think that's the best answer to that kind of argument, because it gives us an opportunity to say, we don't believe in any God. We believe in the God that's described in the Bible. And if you look at the evidence, that's the God that we have. I want to read one really interesting quote by C.K. Chesterton, which I think puts the other side on the defensive rather than us. Somehow or other, an extraordinary idea has arisen that the disbelievers in miracles consider them coldly and fairly, while believers in miracles accept them only in connection with some dogma. The fact is quite the other way. The believers in miracles accept them because they have evidence for them. The disbelievers in miracles deny them because they have a doctrine against them. I did this 3 days. Yes, sir. So,
to this very time, people at this same time still have that veil over their eyes, and they're still not able to see because certain things happen in the world, and they blame God for the things that happen instead of really look to see what they've done in the past and what's taking place, why things ain't the way it's supposed to be, instead of relying on the only God and true God there is that created heaven and everything else, isn't it?
So what you're saying is, the most reasonable way to look at this is that miracles can occur.
Yes, it can.
It's when you have such an emotional issue with something, or you have blinders on, that you don't believe in miracles. So the miraculous is the more belief in the miraculous is the more rational belief, and I agree with that. And I want to close with this. I want to say that the whole reason I did these 3 weeks on miracles is because Mara, who hasn't been here for two of them, said to me one day, you know, why don't you talk about that? It would be interesting. She needed some answers to when she and John and Gloria go down to the 3rd Street Promenade and people ask them about this stuff. You know, she said, I don't know how to answer this. So my point here is that I'll take requests, or any of us who do the teaching. If you have something you want us to tackle and try to make some sense out of it, please don't be afraid to ask myself or Mark or... One more thing, and then I'm going to close.
You know, miracles happen all over the world at this very moment. You know, because I have a friend of mine, he's a prophet, and then prophets are in South Africa, England, India, all over France, and miracles happen everywhere that he goes. They even got people flying. But, you know, certain things happen, and there's been evangelists that go to all different churches that come and speak in the churches that explain all these stuff that's happening. But what I'm trying to say is, in saying that in Africa, there's all kind of miracles going on to this very moment.
Yeah, I agree with you. If you don't believe in this, find a missionary that's from Southeast Asia or from Africa or parts of South America, and they will talk to you about the spiritual weirdness that goes on every day, all the time, constantly, that is not explainable. And I'm 7 minutes over, so thank you, everybody.